Bonnie got up, smiled, and went out. The elegant woman stretched out her hand for me to shake. "We will notify your school in a few weeks. It was very nice to meet you." I shook hands all around and backed out of the room in a fog, silent as if pantomime had taken my voice and the urge to speak. On the way home, Mommy kept asking me, "What happened?" And I kept mumbling, "Nothing, nothing, nothing happened." Ashamed that after all those hours of practice with Mrs. Johnson, Mr. Barone, and Mr. Gaddy, after the expense of new clothes, shoes, and after Mommy had to take a day off from work to take me to Manhattan, after all of that, I had failed the audition and would never, ever get out of Brooklyn.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Antonia Cerejido, in for María Hinojosa. And today, a portrait of Esmeralda Santiago. This is Esmeralda Santiago, reading from her book, When I Was Puerto Rican. I interviewed the iconic writer back in December about her life and work. Today, we're bringing that conversation to you. Esmeralda Santiago moved to Brooklyn, New York, from Puerto Rico at the age of 13, and her writing touches on the two worlds she inhabited growing up. In her first book, When I Was Puerto Rican, Esmeralda recounts her life as a young, intelligent, and curious Puerto Rican girl who suddenly finds her world upended when she moves to New York. I sat down with Esmeralda for a live interview at the 92nd Street Y on the 25th anniversary of the publishing of When I Was Puerto Rican. Esmeralda kicked off our event by reading an excerpt from her book, some of which we heard at the top of the show. She was describing how she felt when she bombed an audition to get into LaGuardia High School, a famed arts high school in Manhattan. But she actually got in. And in this next part, she returns to her high school, years after graduating, and runs into one of her old teachers, who was also one of the judges at the infamous audition.
She told me that the panel had asked me to leave that day so they could laugh. Because it was so funny to see a 14-year-old Puerto Rican girl jabbering out a monologue about a possessive mother-in-law at the turn of the century, the words incomprehensible because she went by so fast. "We admired," she said, "the courage it took to stand in front of us and do that, and do what you did." "So you mean I didn't get into the school because of my talent, but because I had chutzpah?" We both laughed. "Are any of your sisters and brothers in college?" "No, I'm the only one so far." "How many of you are there?" "By the time I graduated from high school, there were 11 of us." 11? She looked at me for a long time until I had to look down. "Do you ever think about how far you've come?" she asked. "No," I answered. "I never stop to think about it. It might jinx the momentum." "Let me tell you another story then," she said. "The first day of your first year, you were absent. We called your house. You said you couldn't come to school because you had nothing to wear. I wasn't sure if you were joking. I asked to speak to your mother, and you translated what she said. She needed you to go somewhere with her to interpret. At first, you wouldn't tell me where. But then you admitted that you were going to the welfare office. You were crying, and I had to assure you that you were not the only student in the school whose family received public assistance. The next day, you were here, bright and eager. And now here you are, about to graduate Harvard." "I'm glad that you made that call," I said. "And I'm glad that you came to see me. But right now, I have to teach a class." She stood up as graceful as I remember. "Take care. One of these days."
As we just heard, you studied performing arts. But now you're a writer. So when did you become a writer? We now know about the beginnings of your performing career.
Well, I've had so many jobs that I was constantly trying to make a living. But I never thought that I would be a writer. I think I became a writer in the process of the many jobs that I had, the many people that I met, the many experiences that I lived through, and began to write really when I realized that stories like mine were hard to find in the literature in the United States, and I decided I was tired of being invisible in this culture, so I started to write for that reason.
In high school or already?
No, I was already an adult. I already had children. You know, I've always been a reader, but I was always aware that I didn't exist in the literature of the United States. And I found Nicolás Amor. I found Piri Thomas. But that was pretty much it that you could find at that time. And then when I had children, I realized, my children are going to have the same kind of questions about why aren't people who identify with Puerto Rico, why are we not visible in this country? And I began to write about my experience as a Puerto Rican in the United States as a way of fixing that, which I thought was broken.
You've lived on the U.S. mainland for a long time, for decades now, and you continue to write about Puerto Rico, including history. And you wrote La Conquistadora, and if I'm not mistaken, one, if not both of the books you're writing now are history books. Why continue to write about Puerto Rico, not the U.S. mainland? And what about history excites you?
Well, I write about Puerto Rico because we all know what's going on here.
Yeah, that's true.
So I want to tell a story that hasn't been told. Mm-hmm. And I think everything that I write is history because everything's in the past. I'm not writing about what's happening right now in my life. So I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated by how people think history is something that people make or do or make up. We make history by existing and moving and doing things and making choices and making demands or ordering or decisions. So I think that because I feel myself as a person who's creating history just by existing, that's what I write about. I write about existence and about what happens. And I'm fascinated by the people who are not in the histories. And like my family, you know, if you look at the literature of Puerto Rico, it mostly was written by white, literate, educated, Spain-descended people, you know? Very, very few stories were written like me, like my family, like my parents and grandparents. You know, number one, most of them were illiterate because the illiteracy was very high in that part of the world, but also nobody asked them about their lives. You know, you are Luis Muñoz Rivera sitting with your nice suit, looking out the window at a jíbaro over there, and you're writing some romantic ode to a jibarita walking across and how her hips are moving and all that, you know. Oops, excuse me. And I am that jibarita, you know, and I don't want that guy looking at me that way. I want him to see how hard it is to be out on that plowing field with the sun and you haven't eaten anything. That's the people I want to write about. And those people didn't exist in our literature, and it certainly is not in the literature in English in the United States about Puerto Ricans. So I'm that generation that wanted to fix things, you know, so I want to fix that too.
Coming up on Latino USA, my conversation with Esmeralda Santiago continues. Stay with us, no te vayas.
These days, Senator Elizabeth Warren is driving around Iowa in an RV campaigning. And on the back,
we have a huge sign that says, "Honk if you want big structural change."
And according to Warren, it is getting attention.
We had truckers coming by, and they were really on the big air horns, and that was fun.
The NPR Politics podcast hit the road to ask Warren about all that structural change she's calling for. Subscribe to listen.
Esmeralda Santiago joined me on stage last year for a live interview about her life and her work. In addition to her most famous debut novel, When I Was Puerto Rican, she also writes historic nonfiction and about her romantic life, such as in her book, The Turkish Lover. We return to that conversation now.
I was rereading Turkish Lover, and there was a sentence that I really loved that was, "Lost was a Puerto Rican afternoon humming with bees, the proud cackle of a hen with chicks, the sudden loud thunder and pounding rain of a tropical squall. Lost was not feeling safe, even in our own apartments." Your childhood was marked by hurricane season. You remember big hurricanes. You recently went back to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. What was it like to grow up with hurricanes, and how did you see the island now when you were just there?
Well, you know, as a child, the hurricanes, of course, are terrifying when it's happening, not really because you're scared, but because the adults are freaking out. And so you don't know when you're a kid. And then, of course, the very big one that I remember was Santa Clara. My brother was, my young brother was like 40 days old. So I remember it very particularly. And I remember when we came out of our neighbor's home, that there was nothing left. I mean, there was nothing left. And you just can't, even as a child.
Yeah, like not even trees, right?
Yeah, they're, you know, like, or they're stunted. You know, it's like there used to be branches and there's no leaves. And you can't understand what happened. And then I think the fear comes in because you're used to, I mean, I remember, you know, you're hungry, you go get a mango or an avocado or a banana, you know, and all of a sudden those kinds of things were not available, but also just how nervous and scared the adults were because they were supposed to take care of the children. And we all of a sudden were very aware of the fact that they couldn't take care of us. That was something that I've never forgotten and how difficult it was for them. But, you know, that climate, within a week, things begin to flower. It's just the land was so fertile that very quickly as a child, I forgot that this had happened. But, of course, the parents are still dealing with this for months, you know, trying to recover, build a house, get fresh water, get food, all those kinds of things that as a child you don't really think about. It just kind of appears, or you can just pick it off the tree. And so it was just in Puerto Rico in October, and now, of course, I go there as an adult, having a real sense of what happened there, having spoken to many of my friends. And it's a completely different way of looking at the devastation, because when you're a little kid, you don't think, oh, I can't get mangoes anymore. But then when you're an adult and you realize the ecology has been devastated, you know, now I'm as afraid as my parents and the adults around me were, because they knew what was happening in a way that I didn't.
So you write a lot about the intimate relationships of your life. And so inevitably you talk about the power dynamics between men and women. I remember in When I Was Puerto Rican, the time where your piano teacher is inappropriate with you, then when your great uncle pinches your breast and then gives you a dollar. Turkish Lover, what the entire book is about, a relationship with a very controlling man. Mm-hmm. We're living right now through a moment in which women are demanding that men take greater responsibilities for their actions. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you think about the Me Too movement and if it's impacted the way that you look at your own work.
Well, I think the Me Too movement is great, not a moment too soon. You know, I think that it's really important to be able to be open about these experiences, because, you know, if you are a woman who has been in some way approached in that way by a predatory man, you need to be able to acknowledge that that happened in your life, because otherwise you carry it as a burden for the rest of your life with no understanding. So I think it's really great that women are coming forward and they're talking about this and they're giving up the shame of mm-hmm. that experience. And that's really important. And I mean, for me, when you talk about, I write a lot about my intimate life, do I really? I don't know, I guess I do.
No, I sometimes I read your stuff, I'm like, I can't look at an ex's Facebook page, let alone like dwell on a moment that was like uncomfortable. I'm like, when did she find the strength to write this?
Well, you know, sometimes you, I think there was a point in my life, I don't know when it happened, to tell you the truth, but there was a moment in my life when I just gave up shame for a lot of things that I had no control over.
Oh my God, how do we get there? When yeah. did that?
I don't know what happened. I think it's maturity. I think it's age. I think it's also realizing that, well, you know, as an example, I have a 20-year-old niece who's very much a young woman, and she's very, very concerned about what her cohorts think about her, about what she wears or how she behaves or whatever. And I'm going to her, you're not going to know these people in a few years. I mean, they're not even going to be around. Why are you worrying about them? They are not going to be in your life. I can say that now, you know, but of course, when I was her age, I was freaking out over wearing the right thing and all that kind of thing. But when you get to a certain point in your life, you realize, you know, those things are really not that important, and that there are people who are going to be in your life for the rest of your life, and those people you treasure, you value, you respect, and you're with, right? And then there's a lot of people that, who cares what they think, you know? And so I got to that point where I don't care. I think a lot of the humiliations that I had when I first came to the United States, it was because I was ashamed of the way that people were responding to me. And I wasn't realizing that, wait a second, the things that I'm doing are really good. You know, I'm working really hard to learn English, to have a job, to be educated, to do all these positive things. And all these people are saying nasty things about me. This is not about me. This is about them. That's their problem. I'm not going to worry about them. But, you know, it's a process of reaching that point. And I wish I could do that and say, ta-da. But you have to find that place in your own life and make that decision. And it really is a decision, I think, because when you give up shame, you also give up a lot of people because they make you feel bad. But you get used to feeling bad from that person. And so after a while, you're just going like, why am I spending my time with this person? I mean, this makes no sense, you know?
I don't think anyone has learned to read as many times as you have. First, you learned to read Spanish in Puerto Rico when you were a child. Then you came to the United States and you learned to read in English. And then nearly 10 years ago, you had a stroke and you lost the ability to read and write, and then you regained it. I'm curious, for those who don't know the story of what happened with your stroke, if you could talk a little bit about that. And then what have you learned about learning through this process?
Yeah. Well, you know, I just woke up one day and I couldn't understand anything that I tried to read. It's one of the first things I do in the mornings. I read the paper and I realized I have no idea. This is written in what language is this, you know? And I called my doctor, of course, and they discovered that I had a very size of a head of a pin. Stroke, and it affected only the reading and writing comprehension. So I could write anything. I had no problems writing, but I didn't know, I couldn't read it. And I didn't know that what I was writing made any sense because I couldn't understand it. But I did, at a very early stage, I realized I could understand everything that was said to me. So I said, well, I started listening to audiobooks, and because I have to read, otherwise I would die. And so I realized at one point, I go like, you know, the same thing happened to me. When I came to the United States, I could look at a book and I didn't understand what it said. You know, I have to do the same thing. And my doctors told me, you know, the brain is elastic and it can find other ways to do the same thing. So I basically started to learn how to read and write again the way I would have when I was a little kid, writing, you know, with a primer, and just little by little until I was able to understand simple concepts, and then went on until I was able to do the whole thing. But it was a process, you know.
One of my favorite aspects of the story, you did a piece on Latino USA about this, that you had a friend who brought you a stack of newspapers. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
When I told him what had happened, he called me and I told him what was happening. And so he says, well, I'm coming over, you know. And so he showed up with a stack of magazines like this. And at the very top is something like, you know, children's books or children's stories. And then Tiger Beat, and then People Magazine, and then Good Housekeeping. At the very bottom was the New Yorker. So he said, you just start at the top, and when you get down there, you know that you are okay. And I thought it was so wonderful, you know. And there was a point in my life when I know way too much about Britney Spears and Justin Bieber. And, you know, it's like I really knew the culture, everything. I knew all the affairs. I had read all that stuff. But it was a wonderful idea. And he was an educator, and it was very smart that he did that. And I'm a good student, so I did that. And you know, what did I learn about learning? I learned that you can learn anything at any point if you apply yourself, and if you believe that you can do it. I think I was very fortunate. I didn't have massive muscular issues with my stroke. So I could really concentrate. How do I understand things? And I did it.
Thank you to Esmeralda Santiago for joining us for our live event, which marked the 25th anniversary of the publication of her book, When I Was Puerto Rican. This episode was produced by Sayer Quevedo and edited by Sofia Paliza Carr. The Latino USA team includes Fernanda Camarena, Miguel Macias, Maggie Freeling, and Janice Yamoka, with help this week from Jeannie Montalvo. Our engineers are Stephanie Lebeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Fernanda Uriegas. And we also have to say a fond goodbye to our outgoing fellow, Jess Alvarenga. Good luck in your next endeavors, Jess. We are very proud of you. Our interns are Lucas Southard and Jonathan Cabral. Special thanks this week to Ricky Maldonado, Bernard Schwartz, and Frank Cantor. Our theme music was composed by Senia Ruinos. If you'd like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our executive producer is Maria Hinojosa. I'm your host this week, Antonia Cerejido. Join us again next time, and in the meantime, you can find us on social media. Adios!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
How many New Yorkers are in the audience? Woo! Yeah!
I'm Antonia Cerejido. Next time on Latino USA, we enter the United States Senate chamber and follow the senators as they try to reform our immigration system. The twist? They're all in fourth grade. That's next time on Latino USA.